This morning we'll be discussing the concluding verses of chapter 8. So texts 49 through 52. Just a little review here. Queen Kunti was the second interruption. Uttara was the first interruption. Krishna is ready to go. He's on his chariot and Uttara is stopping him. Then that calamity is taken care of. Krishna is ready to go. Queen Kunti interrupts Krishna's departure, pleading with him to stay. That although Krishna is Bhakta Vatsala, he is also supremely independent. And after hearing her prayers, Krishna mildly smiled. That smile was as enchanting as his mystic power. He accepted the prayers of Queen Kunti. He informed other ladies of his departure by entering the Hastinapur palace, and once again he's ready to go, and Yudhisthira comes and lovingly implores Krishna to remain some more days. So though Krishna's fully independent, he understands the the grief of Maharaj Yudhisthira, so he agrees to stay. Already there, it was mentioned, three Ashvamedha yagyas were performed, the purpose of which was to create auspiciousness for the new king, and by Karmakanda ritual, if any inauspiciousness was there, to remove that inauspiciousness for the consequences of the battle itself. So Yudhisthira begins to speak in text 48, speaking to Krishna. He says, "O my lot, I am the most sinful man. Just see my heart, which is full of ignorance. This body, which is ultimately meant for others, has killed many phalanxes of men. Prabhupada would sometimes look for a good synonym for akshohini. Sometimes he would use this word phalanx, or a division, some military terms, like a large number. So it's very scientific. Gives in the purport the numbers. Foot soldiers, 109,650. Horseback, 65,600. Chariots, 21,870. And elephants, same, 21,870. So many of such persons were killed, and the animals, the elephants and the horses, and the chariot drivers and the charioteers, infantry, great generals. So Because the premise or the root of his lamentation is the body of a good person is meant to serve others. And any religion or tradition or culture appreciates like that. Persons are honored for the sacrifices they make for the welfare of others. That's universal. So while we have this life, or even specifically life, or the body, it's meant for service to others. During this life, and then Prabhupada would like to speak about after this life. In the Parsi community, the body, the dead body is thrown for the jackals and wolves and, you know, for their food. Or when the body is buried, then it becomes food for worms. And if the body is burned, it then becomes ashes, so it goes to the earth. So during this life, the body is meant for service. After life, the body is meant for service. Bodies are meant for service. And Yudhisthira is filled with grief because that's his value of life, and now look what's happened. The body has been the cause of the destruction of so many other bodies. So many Akshayini divisions of soldiers, elephants and horses. In addition to the soldiers, next he's lamenting, I've killed many boys, brahmanas, well-wishers, friends, parents, preceptors, and brothers. Though I live millions of years, I will not be relieved from the hell that awaits me for all these sins. At several points, in war, aside from the soldiers on the field, invariably others who are innocent bystanders, they're also hurt. And according to Vedic codes, there are certain groups of persons that are never to be harmed in any circumstance. Brahmanas, women, children, killing them is forbidden. And yet, Maharaj Yudhisthira is saying, look, what I'm responsible for. Just thinking of the deaths of so many persons on my account? Horrible. And he mentions that though I live millions of years, that is, you know, if I can live out the karma in this life, it's too much karma. That the hell that's awaiting me is just going to be overwhelming. I should be severely punished for this. All this killing of innocent people. Then his next one is for a virtuous king who acts to protect his citizens, to the act of protecting the citizens, because he's the administrator, there's harm to come to the citizens. For such killing, there's no reaction. But this doesn't apply to me. His reasoning is that I wasn't even the king. Duryodhan was the king. And he was doing a good job. people were, the government was going on quite okay, and so what was the issue here? The issue was, I'm to become the king, not him. And for that, so much killing, this protection from religious principle does not apply to me. So the perspective that's being presented here is that violence that's for self-aggrandizement from a ruler, king, kshatriya type of personality, for self-aggrandizement, it's punishable. It's not just because I'm a king I can do these things. The purpose must be right. So he's saying that was the purpose. So much violence and harm to citizens came just to put me on the throne instead of Duryodhana, who was doing all right. From a material point of view, he was doing all right, but from Krishna's point of view, he wasn't doing all right. Or, you know, what's from the Bhagavatam message here, what's all right and what's not all right? It's just that, like, in New York, when Giuliani was mayor, from a Duryodhan perspective, he was a good mayor. Crime went way down. The roads got fixed. I mean, I don't know if you've driven in New York City late, but, you know, Giuliani's not the mayor anymore. And the roads are terrible. And crime is back up. Don't be comparing, you know, this Duryodhan versus that Duryodhan. Giuliani is much better mayor. But is that enough? From Krishna's perspective, Duryodhan had, the government was going very nicely. He was, administratively, quite skilled. But from Krishna's perspective, Duryodhan has to be relieved. And why, what was the principle that Krishna wanted Duryodhan to be removed? Because he was demoniac. So demons can be very well organized. So many examples in history can be pointed to. Even modern, just like really recent history. Pointing fingers. You know, the military expertise of this country, that country, the other country have been shown. You know, like, you know, we're tough dogs. Look out, because we got tanks, we got military, we got artillery, we got planes, we can crunch our opponents. Look out, here we come. So, that's not enough. From Krishna's perspective. So that the lamentation of Yudhisthira on the one hand is showing his soft-hearted position as a devotee, like Arjuna, and Prabhupada would honor that. This is the quality of a devotee. He's not interested in taking some power and controlling and being the enjoyer of that power and the facility. That's not a devotee. They're soft in heart. And sometimes Prabhupada would criticize that it's on the platform of the body, lamenting like this. And that's, but it's setting this, the other thing is it's setting the stage for the next chapter. The next chapter is Bhishma is going to pacify Yudhisthira. And the way he's going to pacify him is not just by patting him on the head. He's going to give him a higher purpose of life than what Yudhisthira is pointing to as religious principle. So it's higher than religious principle. It's transcendental principle. It doesn't mean transcendental principle throws away religious principle. But religious principle should be guided by transcendental principle. And if it's not guided by transcendental principle, then it's mistaken. Misdirected religion. Doesn't solve the problems of life. And that goes into the next. I have killed so many friends and women, and I have caused enmity to such an extent that it is not possible to undo it by material welfare work. So there's this, minus the transcendental perspective, there's this religious perspective that says in every endeavor there's some type of fault. We discussed it yesterday morning. Chapter 18, text 48 of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna describes in every endeavor. And it's like every endeavor, there's some type of fault. Every endeavor is covered by some type of fault. So even you try to do good things, every endeavor is covered by some type of fault. So what do you do with those faults, those discrepancies? The Karmakanda section of the Vedas has some prescription for those faults. There's some antidote for the faults, some atonement for faults, some type of Karmakanda ritual that takes into account those faults and addresses those faults. Of course, there's faults with the Karmakanda rituals. But his point is, the extent of what I have done, living millions of years and taking shelter under, well, it was done for the right cause, or I'll do some Karmakanda rituals. It's too much. He's feeling overwhelmed. The process of sacrifice is there for getting relief from unintentional sins, unavoidable mistakes in the course of one's duties of life. But what are those rituals? The Ashvamedha Yajna that he just did, three of them, horse sacrifice. It's not that in a horse sacrifice the horse is killed, that the idea is in a horse sacrifice the older horse, however they do the selection process, enters into the fire and comes out young horse, rejuvenated, showing the power of the mantras of the Brahmins. Where are the Brahmins that can do that? Poor horse. Poor Brahmin. And poor supporter of the yajna. It was maybe 3 or 4 years ago. Maybe more than that. There was a big advertisement all over Chicago. They were going to have an Ashwamedha Yajna. And they needed enormous amounts of wealth. I don't know if it happened or not. I guess the Brahmanists who were behind it got something. They also probably got something as a reaction. I don't know whether they had. I was shocked. But because they don't have knowledge of the Bhagavatam, the knowledge of what is the yajna for this age of Kali, they're looking to these other processes that they don't have the qualifications for. So a message of the Bhagavatam that we're receiving here is that the antidote for unavoidable mistakes and conflicts that arise just due to social intercourse is actions, duties that are done selflessly. If actions or duties are performed selfishly, there's reactions.
It's very similar to the theme of the presentation last night, or the punchline of the presentation last night, that as long as the conception of self is on the platform of the body, A, it's not who we really are. B, it's going to be selfish, not selfless. The disconnect with the personality of Godhead is locked in by a bodily conception of self. And spiritual conception of self frees one from that selfishness, because the soul connected to the Supreme Soul is the servant of the Supreme Soul. And so selfless acts, that's the antidote. Doing our duties in a selfless manner, simply for service to others. Such a really basic point, but the idea of service to others on the platform of the body rules. If there's service to others, if then it's by the Vedic conception, it's extended selfishness. My family, my community, my race, my nation, my group, all in terms of the body, or groups of bodies. And even one can put some notion of God somewhere in that. If the conception is on the platform of the body, then there's bondage to what we do, the work that we do, and then there's faults, there's flaws. We're bound to those flaws, and hellish life is awaiting us. And Prabhupada writes, that's the way of karma. It creates one action and another reaction simultaneously, and thus increases the chain of material activities, binding the performer in material bondage. What's the release button? Action in the spiritual conception, where and from the soul, we're serving the Supreme Soul. Guided by theistic conduct, but the consciousness behind that action needs to be service unto the Supreme Soul. So Prabhupada writes, the battle of Kurukshetra was actually fought by the will of the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna, as is evident from his version. And only by his will was Yudhisthira placed on the throne of Hastinapur. Therefore, factually, no sin whatsoever touched the Pandavas or the order carriers of the Lord. So that's like, okay, Yudhisthira's not responsible, then why all this lamenting? It's contradictory, because if he was doing it for the Lord and for the Lord only, and this is what Krishna wanted, and therefore he fought, and therefore he got on the throne, and therefore why is he lamenting? Maybe he wasn't in that consciousness. Well, he was in that consciousness, because otherwise he wouldn't have acted to do such things. He was resisting and holding back and carefully considering and Krishna wanted it, and so he did it. But so it's the situation we should understand. It's not like he's lamenting like we lament. He's in this situation so that Bhishma Dev can appear on the scene and establish transcendental truth, and Krishna can show the spotlight on Bhishma Dev. Da 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 da, look at Grandfather Bhishma Dev. He's great. He's greater than me. Even I can't pacify Yudhisthira, but Bhishma Dev can pacify Yudhisthira. Ba 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 ba. Krishna likes to do like that, and so Yudhisthira is moaning and whining and carrying on like we do. But apparently virtuous, because he's certainly virtue personified. But misplaced virtue can lead to lamentation. Untoward lamentation. He concludes the chapter, text 52. As it is not possible to filter muddy water through mud, or purify a wine-stained pot with wine, it is not possible to counteract the killing of men by sacrificing animals. So he's referring to the three Ashvamedha yagyas that were directed by Krishna and executed by Domya, and so he's right. If leaving aside Krishna wanted the battle to happen and Krishna wanted Yudhisthira on the throne and all that, if it's just on the religious side, as a king, he was rightful. The throne was rightfully his. And look at these Kauravas. I mean, by laws of Manu, they should be put to death. Attempted murder multiple times. Stealing of property, there's another one. And disgracing Draupadi, another one. You know, all those reasons, by laws of Manu, death penalty. Triple death penalty. So they weren't irreligious. It wasn't just, you did this to me, I'll get back on you. It wasn't that kind of tit for tat. It was religious principle. But then, even in religious principle, there is mistake. There's flaw. So, what to do? And he's saying, Karmakanda ritual doesn't work. It doesn't work because it doesn't purify the heart. It can counteract, but it can't purify the heart. So he gives these three examples: filtering muddy water through mud. Well, that's kind of obvious. You can't. You just get more mud in the water. Or wine-stained pots. I've heard Prabhupada lecture on this many times, and the notion here is if even one drop of wine or alcohol touches, this is speaking specifically clay pots, then the pot's contaminated and you throw the pot away. You can't wash the pot once it has that contamination. No amount of washing. You throw away the pot, you get another pot. So, similarly, activity, that's the second example. The third example is sins counteracted by sacrificing an animal. Now, Prabhupada points out in this third example, it's not that the life of the animal is taken. That would, when there's unqualified brahmanas that cannot, by power of mantra, bring a new life, a young horse out of the fire, then the animal's losing his life. And what's the idea? You have sins, you put a horse in the fire and you're freed from sins. It's more sin on top of the other sin. So therefore, in the Puranas, there are five activities that are strictly prohibited for the sage of Kali. One of them is horse sacrifice and the cow sacrifice, or bull. Same thing with another gomedic yagya. The animal would be, the bull would enter into the fire and come out young body. It wasn't magic, it was mantra, the power of mantra. So since there aren't brahmanas that have that qualification of power of mantra chanting, forbidden. So then what to do for the reactions of sins? Therefore, the sacrifice for this age is Nam Sankirtan, Sankirtan Yagya. Yagyai Sankirtana Prayair Yajantihi Sumedasa. Prabhupada is writing here that Yudhisthira is hinting at what's going to come next. If the qualification of the brahmanas today at the end of Dwarpa Yuga is insufficient to neutralize sins, what to speak of the age of Kali when conditions become even more worse? Such sacrifices are not to be done. So the chanting of the holy name is recommended, and in general the path of devotional service. Now, it's not that the path of devotional service was like not available in previous ages, but in previous ages when persons were far more qualified, then even these rituals had a deeper meaning than when consciousness was not so elevated as today. Why were these people wanting an Ashwamedha Yagya? Well, there's two reasons. To have an Ashwamedha Yagya, you have to have enormous wealth, and so the fellows who were organizing the thing was just a fundraiser for themselves. Enormous wealth. So much for you, so much for me, and so much for the other guy, and then we'll have the yagya. And the other is some notion that we become prosperous by this yagya. Everybody likes to prosper. Okay, let's have a big one. So that purpose of let us prosper is not the purpose of Maharaj Yudhisthira. Not the purpose of Lord Krishna. It's not why Krishna wanted the three Ashwamedha Yagyas performed. For bringing welfare to the citizens is the purpose. Because that's the duty of the king. So that the king should become pious, or be pious, so that the citizens, the welfare of the citizens is guaranteed because they're under his protection, and he's protected by religious principle, by his piety. One needs a pious king. And in the age of Kali, good luck. And Prabhupada would very quickly go down his commentary. What does it mean to democracy? And he would sometimes graphically spell it out and then retreat and say, oh, if people heard us speaking like this, then they might think that we're revolutionaries or something. So. Mm-hmm. But I'm just speaking the message of the Bhagavatam. I'm not trying to bring revolution. I'm just hearing it this morning. Prabhupada was describing when it's votes bring the politician into power, then practically speaking it means that the politician has to be a back scratcher. He has to do what those people with money want, and that's what he supports, and that gets him elected. And so there's different constituencies with money, and money makes power, because power decides, that money decides who gets elected. It's disgusting. It's not about, you know, they can speak their platitudes, but it's not about those values. It's whereas the king, you know, he didn't have to do that. He didn't do that. The proper king was subordinate to the brahmanas, and they would guide him according to the scripture, and that's what he would do. And because he did like that, it actually brought prosperity to the countryside, and people were happy because their safety was insured and protected. Their welfare was by dint of this pious king. Yudhisthira is pointing to the path of Shuddha Bhakti indirectly by saying these other measures aren't going to do it, and I'm not protected by these other measures. I'm going to hell, the darkest regions of hell, interminably long, all of the wrong that I've done. So it's paving the way for Grandfather Bhishma, the next chapter, pacifying the Yudhisthira in a very wonderful way. So any discussion?
Guru Maharaj, in today's world we see that leaders go to wars whimsically, and so it's very unsettling and it's extremely dangerous. At the same time, there is also the reality, probably the reactions of materialistic past activities of, you know, terrorism and harm to innocent people that the leader has to protect citizens from. So, but it's such a complex...
It's very complex. The government should not be weak. That's not the advocacy. But, you know, to do things on the basis of religious principle, it really requires a pure person. And even to do the right thing in the right consciousness, that's the greater challenge. And how can one have the right consciousness if they're not on a spiritual platform? If they're not Rajarshis? And how does somebody become a Rajarshi without training? And where's that training? Where are the brahmanas to train? Where are the people that have the qualification? take a leader, a young person who is a potential leader, and train them to become a Rajarshi. Where's the Rajarshi school or academy? And who's going to support somebody if they are? You know, somebody's going to want to come along and put them in their pocket. It's not only complicated, as you say, there's this lack of quality. Big time. So just step back from that, and you know, the Bhagavatam certainly recognized the problem, or the sages of Naimisharanya recognized the problem. There, what's the solution? The systematic hearing of Krishna Katha, of Bhagavad Katha, and embedded within the Bhagavad Katha are principles of elevation and proper action. So that's the cure that the sages of Naimisharanya saw, or that Shukadeva Goswami and Sutta Goswami saw. Therefore, how important the systematic, inculcation of the message, the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam, that it should be very, very deeply studied and understood, and then applied. At least, you know, some class of men require that.
Is
a which?
Indecisiveness.
Indecision.
Indecisiveness.
So, I'm observing, like, moving from the stage where I'm used to taking decisions just because I'm being judged by others, to a stage where I'm able to take firm decisions under guidance. But there is this, so much of tendency to again go back to, after taking the decision, apply my logic and reasoning and analyze it, like here in this particular related to Maharaj Yudhishthira. So again, so much of analysis is going on with respect to what decision I've taken, and then so much it ends up being offensive, like doubting, and how do I stand by the firm decision I made, having received this loan?
There are certain commodities like faith and purity and control of the mind through purity and strong intelligence that you can't. It takes time to grow them. And so in that transition phase, there will be unsteadiness, anishtita bhakti. So it's best that those who are guiding you recognize your capacity and give indications according to capacity, and that you yourself also make decisions according to capacity. Okay, this is the standard. This is my goal. and here's where I am, so let me take one step, or what, you know, reasonable, sustainable step towards that goal. And then if the, you know, if the conditioned mind starts to move, you don't go. I would say corollary with all of this is how you perform your chanting every morning is going to determine how steady your mind is going to be with your decisions. Because those little incremental, the mind wants to go here, the mind wants to go there, the mind is always wanting to go somewhere. And how well you can bring the mind to a position of focus. Direct the mind to the holy name. And receive that strength that comes from being with Krishna in the form of his holy name. That's going to determine the steadiness in your maintaining your decisions. Strength of mind. Purity of mind. Faith in the holy name, faith in transcendence. As opposed to yielding to, as you described, living the wishes of others who aren't transcendentalists. But I couldn't fulfill something, so I want you to fulfill it, and I vicariously through you I'll fulfill it. So you're my instrument of my desires that aren't spiritually based. Feelings, all the feelings that go with that. Well, feelings of resistance or resentment or guilt if I don't, and you know, this whole ocean of the waves of material stuff that's really apart from the platform of the soul. So how you perform your daily chanting will have a huge effect on staying with the decisions you make. Being firm. How can there be happiness if the mind is not controlled? It's always disturbed. And your study of the scripture done in a proper way. Krishna says the last verses in the Bhagavad Gita that he speaks, by studying this sacred conversation, one is worshipping me with their intelligence. So the intelligence can become purified and strengthened if study is done in a proper way. Then your intelligence is stronger and the mind wants to run here and there. And the intelligence directs the mind. So all of those make sense, and then it comes down to, you know, we're not so mature. We're not so pure. And so that's the price we have to pay for our past misuse of free will choices. Just bear with it. Keep moving.
I don't have any practical question, but I have something in the context of the Ashwamedha Yajna. Someone may say that, like, what is the use of getting a young horse body, like, spiritually, how is it beneficial to
the horse? It didn't have use. It didn't have use at all. The purpose is to show visibly the power of mantra. Here is a qualified Brahmin. That's all. And it's, you know, some benefit to the horse. He's got a young body instead of an old body. There's another one, the efficacy of mantra, that they can light fire by mantra. And even there's a detail about it. There's a particular type of wood, arani wood. And arani is a super hard wood, not like balsa or something that's like very easy to ignite, even with a match. There's this hard wood, and just by mantra. So it shows the mantras. So then there's other mantras that do other things. The other mantras that do other things neutralize the reactions of sins. It's more subtle than igniting fire or a horse coming out of the fire. But it's something subtle is to produce something subtle, something that can counteract sin and bring auspiciousness. So one says svasti, svasti, svasti hi, it does something.
I was thinking that in the past, there's so much of hurt that are caused to others, and there's like...
You're going to go down Maharaj Yudhisthira's path?
After, in the presence of this example where he did everything in right consciousness, did the right thing, I feel I don't even stand anywhere, so what is the resolution of...
Toss in the towel and jump off a cliff or something. No. You follow the path of Bhagavad Dharma. Whatever is the wrong from the past, the tatte nukampam so samikshmano, instruction. Don't place your consciousness in, oh, I need some measures to counteract the bad that I've done in the past. And you go and fortify, build a big fort and make your army to fight off the reactions that are going to come from your mistakes. Don't do that. Whatever is to come, let it come. Accept the responsibility for whatever it is, knowingly, unknowingly. So many mistaken actions I've done that have hurt others. I accept the responsibility for that. Now, where do I put my consciousness? If not in that, let me put my consciousness in serving the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. I will not budge one inch from that. So there's instructions how to do that. So that's how you are to conduct your life. Whatever's done is done. The process of bhakti is so powerful it can address that. So place your faith and your energy, your consciousness, your striving to serve the lotus feet of Krishna nicely, favorably, pleasingly. And whatever's going to come will come. Something? Yes.
Maharaj, you've spoken earlier about steadiness. Yeah. I was just wondering if you could help me understand. You mentioned about proper reading of scripture. I was just wondering if you could help me understand. What is the proper way for reading scripture, or how to get that steadiness while reading scripture?
Well, traditionally, even aside from traditionally, and like, you know, even contemporarily, study is done under a master. Universities, look at it. You know, somebody wants to study something. They may want to study how to play sitar. They could just sit down and, you know, hang out with a sitar for a while, but you find a teacher. And then the teacher will say, you know, lessons. And the teacher not only knows, a good teacher not only knows how to play sitar, or knows their field, but they know how to transmit. So one has to find a good teacher. Like, I attended a course in Vrindavan. Well, I was teaching at a course in Vrindavan on one topic, and Mukunda Maharaj, you don't know, but he was one of the first, very, very first disciples of Srila Prabhupada, and the area of service that he developed was communications. Then it was called public relations. Now it's not cool to call it public relations, it's called communications. So he thought, I've devoted 35 years to this, so I should pass it on to other people. So he went to Vrindavan to teach one month course on communications. And what he found was, he knew his subject, but he didn't know how to teach it. And each class that passed, I think it only went for like 4 days, and he was a mess. Just like emotionally, how am I, you know, he was, because Vrindavan is a very intense place. It kind of like takes some impurity and lets you know you've got this impurity. So he then went and took Gurujan's course, The Art of Teaching, because I know my subject, but I don't know the art of teaching. So for study, to steady the intelligence. Steady the intelligence means that it becomes purified. Because what unsteadies the intelligence is contamination. Like, or say, material intelligence. Like, let me learn this so I can get that. And if I can get that, then I can get over on that person or get this thing I want. Or it's just, you know, incentive-oriented rather than service-oriented or serving God and serving others oriented. So, steadiness is purity. Purity is steadiness. So, the study of the scriptures is to bring about purity. So then one needs guidance. Someone that at least they have a sense of what purity is and they're on the path of purity. And they have some teaching skills, so they can help you. And there are systems out there that at least, you know, on a, sorry to say it so bluntly, but at least at a high school level, one can master the subject matter, or like, you know, get an AN exam that says, you know, regurgitation exam, but more deeply, one needs to study where the essence of the message enters one's heart. And a big part of that, once again, is the relationship with the teacher. Just that's the Vedic system. The idea of bringing an apple to the teacher, which is long gone in America, but it was, even when I was beginning in school, it was there. Had something, it's, you know, the sense of gratitude to the teacher, the relationship with the teacher. And it's through the medium of that relationship, that the loving exchange that comes in that relationship, it's that through that medium that the deeper purification takes place, not just information transference, but purification of heart, and then there's steadiness.
Guru Maharaj, could you kindly share Krishna conscious perspectives on death penalty?
Death penalty. Oh, that really fits in with this topic, huh? Oh, because you're just here. Death penalty is, the Krishna conscious perspective is that when the codes of scripture indicate here's the threshold and it's on the other side of the threshold, then death penalty should be given. The threshold is the suffering this soul for this misdeed will suffer in this life enormously, and after this life even greater, and is subject to the receiving soul killing them. So just it's an act of kindness to that soul. They don't have to go through all that, this life, next life, and then be killed in perhaps a violent manner. So the Krishna conscious perspective is, it's two things. There are actions or crimes which are best death punished. And the second thing is, the person who is executing that death penalty or pronouncing the death penalty needs to be, for their sake, they need to be on the right platform of consciousness. Otherwise, we got a whole network of messiness, karmic messiness. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. The Prabhupada Ki Jai.